Portland. Coming up next, the encore edition from our friends at Making Contact, called The Brightness of Courage, the fight for transgender access to gender-specific spaces.
This week on Making Contact.
This is bullying. I've seen comments from adults, not even students, adults, talking about something that they largely have no idea about. I've seen teachers that I've had, people that I've looked up to and respected, publicly denounce me.
Transgender youth and adults faced a heightened state of struggle in state houses, schools, and institutions in 2016. Much of the fight was over rules and regulations about identity and gender expression.
And I'm going to go back to San Francisco and I'm going to walk down the street and I'm going to see a lot of boys and girls, transgender boys and girls, that are hungry, that are laying in sleeping bags on the sidewalk, and I don't get it.
In this edition of Making Contact, we look at a few examples of the struggles and victories over the regulation of gender identity and expression in the U.S. Social safety nets are set up to provide for the most vulnerable populations. They may be seniors on limited incomes, long-term unemployed or underemployed, in a troubled relationship, a former inmate, or a young person on their own for the first time, any of whom may also be transgender. Reporter Larry Buell explored how social service providers in San Francisco and Los Angeles meet the needs of transgender clients, and he found that some can be more welcoming than others.
So this kind of changes from morning to afternoon. It's way more active in the morning because the computers are available.
James Morin is a program supervisor at the Los Angeles LGBT Center. He's taking me on a tour of the youth drop-in facilities.
Watch TV, they have computers.
It's new and bright and painted in turquoise and citrus colors. It's a place you might want to hang around for a while. If you're gay, lesbian, trans, or even LGBT allied youth under 25, you can drop in, get a meal, a hot shower, pick up a change of clothes.
Sometimes we do like spelling bees, we hold community forums.
And if you're homeless, you can stay the night. 12 emergency bunk beds are provided by the center, and 10 are paid by LA County. They're always full.
The residential facilities that we have are open to everyone, but the majority of the people who are able to access them are trans because they're our most vulnerable.
Because, he says, transgender and gender nonconforming youth are at the greatest risk of exploitation and violence on the streets.
I am 19 years old, and my gender is that I'm a trigender. Trigender is basically a gender where you fluctuate between three genders. Mine, I float in between being pangender, which is encompassing all genders, and then female, and then demi-female, which is female but having male characteristics as well.
Rachel suffered abuse from her stepdad, and when she was 12, she was placed in foster care. A note, we're using a pseudonym to protect her identity. She had a fallout with her latest foster family over her gender identity. That landed her on the streets of Long Beach. After 2 weeks, she learned about housing options with the LA LGBT Center. She scored a space in the center's long-term transitional housing, which, like its emergency shelter, is at capacity.
Sleeping in Long Beach by the Hyatt over there, I was jumped and people stole my bike. People would always try to get me to go into their cars and try, I guess, to sell me out because they took some of my friends out the same way.
By trying to sell her out, Rachel means prostitution. One in five transgender Americans has been homeless at some point. The Center for American Progress estimates up to 40% of homeless youth are trans. But there's only one temporary shelter for trans people in the U.S. That's in San Francisco. It has 20 beds, and that's not enough to meet the demand. There's a big reason why many trans women are more likely to end up on the street than trans men or cisgender men or women. If they haven't had reassignment surgery, they're forced into male-only shelter spaces, and they don't feel safe sleeping in a room with cisgender men.
Shelters will take you in regardless of your gender identity or sexual orientation, but most of the shelters will house you based on your authentic gender unless you've had surgery.
Army vet Stephanie Page has a good job at the Veterans Administration in San Francisco. Her employers are supportive of her transition, and she's able to afford a place of her own. But she says if she didn't have a friend with a sofa before she landed on her feet, she might have ended up on the street.
As a trans woman, if I went to a shelter and say, hey, I need a place to sleep. If I were able to get in, first of all, because the waiting lists are just enormous, I would be forced to house with cisgender men because I've not completed my medical transition yet. Most trans women would relate to that and would be like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'll sleep in my car. I'll park, you know, at a Walmart parking lot. I'll set up my tent, you know, somewhere remote away from town, whatever it is I have to do, because I would feel safer doing that than being housed in a large room with, you know, 10 beds with nine men staring at me from all directions. You know, no thank you. I'll pass.
My name is Drian Juarez, and I am the program manager for the center's Transgender Economic Empowerment Project.
Drian helps her clients find jobs by first helping them overcome a lifetime of judgment for their gender nonconformity.
We get picked on if we were assigned male at birth, for example, for being too feminine, or if you were assigned female for being too masculine. And so then we start experiencing that discrimination early on that really can be traumatizing and can make it so that we grow up with social awkwardness, with fear of people. And that makes it difficult to go out and get a job, to go out and interview. So yes, you know, from the onset of childhood, the discrimination we experience sets us up for difficulty.
This is something that Rachel knows well.
If you were to go into the interview, you could tell, because as soon as I bring that up, their faces drop, and then they stop really paying attention to what I have to say.
Depending on their circumstances, Drian's clients may need to heal from the trauma of being kicked out of their family, or from incidents of violence, or from the exhaustion of trying to fit into a society that sees gender as binary.
The system for helping people get economically empowered or stable is already stressed and very flawed. You know, there isn't a lot of funding. You have people who have huge caseloads. And so when you put trans on top of all of that already, it seems insurmountable. And when you're talking to a case manager who's never worked with a trans person, then those cultural competency issues come into place. They start using the wrong pronoun. They use offensive language. They want to refer the trans woman, for example, to a men's shelter because in their minds, again, identity is based on genitalia. And so that's what complicates matters, that a system that's already stressed and not doing a good job, you know, when it comes to trans issues, does even worse.
I've heard this over and over. There are LGBT services like the LA LGBT Center and the center in San Francisco, and there are general services for everyone, regardless of gender or sexual orientation, but there are very few services in the U.S. exclusively for trans and gender nonconforming people, even in San Francisco.
And I'm going to go back to San Francisco and I'm going to walk down the street and I'm going to see a lot of boys and girls, transgender boys and girls that are hungry, that are laying in sleeping bags on the sidewalk, and I don't get it.
I met one trans woman with an ambitious plan to help other trans people from slipping through society's cracks. In 1985, Michelle Lael Norsworthy, then a young man, was arrested for second-degree murder for killing a man in a barroom fight.
I was basically a bully. I was just a vicious tough ass.
In the late 90s, prison doctors diagnosed Norsworthy with gender dysphoria. She began hormone therapy in 2000. Years later, prison doctors said she needed gender reassignment surgery due to her chemical castration from long-term hormone treatment. The state of California refused to pay for it. In April 2015, the Ninth Circuit Court ruled that the state must provide surgery. That August, Michelle was abruptly released from prison without surgery.
They had a policy in place that was prejudice or bigoted. It was against transgenders. It was written. And so it was their own bigotry that defeated them.
Michelle moved into a halfway house for female drug addicts, though she's been sober for decades. She says this was the only place she felt safe that would take her.
I found advocacy groups that claimed to be providing services, but when it came right down to it, what I discovered was they were directing transgender people to the same services that the government provides already to everyone. I want to create a house, a residential community, strictly for the transgender community. And I also want to get shelter status for them so I could take any transgender as they approach with that need, with a homelessness, a hunger, or in need of direct services of any, you know, any supportive services that a transgender person might need. I want to be able to provide that immediately, so shelter status would do that. What we've got is we've got a social system that's set up. It's slanted against the transgender community.
Michelle got her nonprofit status in the summer of 2016. For Making Contact, I'm Larry Buell.
You were listening to Making Contact. Thanks to generous support from listeners like you, this program is offered for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcast, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Coming up, we'll hear from Gavin Grimm, a high schooler who made Time Magazine's 30 Most Influential Teenagers of 2016, and a report from Los Angeles on how their public school district works with transgender students and their families. Tenth grader Gavin Grimm began the 2014 school year with a request to be treated as a young man according to his authentic gender. That included access to use the boys' bathroom at Gloucester County High School in Virginia. Gavin is transgender and says he was born male with a female body. School administrators considered his request and took steps to ensure that Gavin be treated as a male student by teachers and staff. It all appeared to be going well enough until some parents and their supporters complained. 7 weeks into the school year, the Gloucester County School Board intervened and voted to ban any transgender student in their district from using bathrooms for their identified gender. The ACLU quickly responded by filing complaints with the Department of Justice and the Department of Education on the boy's behalf. Joshua Block is a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union.
Initially, Gavin hit the local news when he was up there all by himself in front of a school board meeting.
Hello, everybody.
And it was just him talking in a room of hostile adults.
I prepared a speech today, but I think in light of the comments I've heard, it's better for me to speak without this paper.
The result of that meeting was that they postponed an ultimate decision on what to do. And Gavin, all by himself, was on the local news all over the place.
First of all, to address the most pressing, the most recurring theme I've seen, everyone here that's spoken about me so far has referred to me as a girl. This is the first mistake, seeing as I very simply am not a girl. We know, as a scientific fact, that there is, in fact, research to support that this is in no way, shape, or form a choice. I want to address the questions, why can't I use the nurse's room? Why can't I use a separate bathroom? Why can't I use the woman's room? First of all, I did, in fact, have to use the nurse's room for the first part of the year. This was alienating. It was humiliating. And seeing as the nurse's office is in one place in a very large school, it took a lot of time away from my education. I want to also address the comments that maybe I am unsafe. No, I'm not. I use the public restroom, the men's public restroom, in every public space in Gloucester County and others. I have never once had any sort of confrontation of any kind. No student at the school has ever confronted me in the restroom. No adult in any venue has ever had a problem with me exercising my right to use the restroom. The adults are the only people who have been trying to restrict my rights. I've never been happier exercising my right to be who I am. I did not ask to be this way. And it's one of the most difficult things anyone can face. This is bullying. I've seen comments from adults, not even students, adults, talking about something that they largely have no idea about. I've seen teachers that I've had, people that I've looked up to and respected, publicly denounce me. This could be your child, your sister, your brother, your niece, your nephew. I am not the only transgender student in Gloucester County, and I deserve the rights of every other human being. I am just a human. I am just a boy. Please consider my rights when you make your decision. Thank you very much.
The first meeting actually was put on the agenda at the very last minute, Gavin and his parents didn't even know about it. They heard through third-hand information the day of the meeting that the board was going to discuss the topic of restrooms. And so Gavin and his parents showed up. Gavin was forced to effectively out himself to the entire community as the transgender boy who was using the restroom. And after public comments during that meeting, the school board decided to consider the issue for a couple weeks before coming to a final decision. And they took a couple weeks and they got input from the Department of Education, from the ACLU, and from advocates on the other side of the issue. And they ultimately passed the policy that they did, which categorically barred Gavin from using any boys' restroom anywhere on school property.
Gavin Grimm and the ACLU sued the Gloucester County School Board for allegedly discriminating against the teenager under Title IX and violating his civil rights. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in Gavin's favor, but the school board petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to review the decision. And the High Court agreed to hear it. But after Trump took office, a key piece of Obama administration guidance on the issue was rescinded, and the Supreme Court sent the case back down to the Fourth Circuit.
It's very rare to see a school board and in a community enact an entire policy that's sort of prompted by one specific kid just using the bathroom. And what was pretty amazing was that all of the objections to Gavin using the bathroom weren't really about Gavin. They were all sorts of wild theories that if we allow him to use the bathroom, then that means that at some future point, some hypothetical, you know, sexual predator could come off the street and use the girls' restroom. When in the meantime, you have a human being right in front of them who's just trying to use the bathroom and isn't causing any harm to anyone.
The concoction of a hypothetical bathroom predator isn't unique to Gloucester County School Board. It's a message that's been echoed on the debate floor of state houses across the country. According to a 2016 report by the Human Rights Campaign, 20 states introduced 55 bills that would make it legal to discriminate against transgender people. Some of the bills would have limited transgender access to public spaces and programs, spaces like bathrooms, sports teams, and locker rooms. Others would have allowed for businesses and individuals to discriminate against transgender adults and children with impunity based on religious or moral beliefs. Three bills passed in Mississippi, Oklahoma, and North Carolina. So who is pitching these bills to lawmakers?
It's a conservative religious activist movements. It's Alliance Defending Freedom and Focus on the Family and the Family Research Council that for years have been framing their agenda around barring gay people and same-sex couples from marrying, and they've moved on to transgender people as the next target. The policy that was written by the Gloucester School Board was drafted in the first instance by this group, Alliance Defending Freedom. And Alliance Defending Freedom has been shopping that policy around to school districts across the country and to legislatures across the country.
ACLU attorney Josh Block. The Obama administration and the Departments of Education and Justice all came out aggressively in 2016 in defense of civil rights for transgender students. Their efforts underscored Title IX, which prohibits discrimination based on sex and gender identity.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for being here.
U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch and the DOJ Civil Rights Division filed lawsuits against several public entities in North Carolina, including Governor Pat McCrory and the University of North Carolina. The DOJ's action was in response to a suit filed against the agency.
None of us can stand by when a state enters the business of legislating identity and insists that a person pretend to be something or someone that they are not, or invents a problem that does not exist as a pretext for discrimination and harassment.
Back on the West Coast, The LA Unified School District has a longer history than most when it comes to addressing the needs of transgender students and their families. Reporter Lena Nozizwe looks at the role LA School District played in the passage of the Historic School Success and Opportunity Act. The law clarified the rights of transgender students in California public schools. There are, however, some students who wonder about the effectiveness of the policies.
LA Unified decided that it was high time that we took a very serious look at how we were supporting our transgender students. We saw that our students were having challenges at school, they were disengaged, and their academics were suffering.
That's Judy Chasen, both the head cheerleader and chief implementer of the Los Angeles Unified School District's policies regarding LGBTQ and transgender students, testifying 3 years ago in front of the California Senate Education Committee. The topic is AB 1266, and she's explaining how LA Unified Schools came to set forth a model policy in 2005 that has been replicated around the country. The state's adaptation of LA's policy became law in 2014, what's known as the School Success and Opportunity Act, reaffirmed the rights of transgender students.
Our policy was both simple and profound. All students shall be able to attend school, learn, and participate in school activities, all the while having their gender identity affirmed and respected, regardless of their assigned birth sex.
I am a multiracial, this transgender nonconforming femme youth of color.
I am queer. I'm a queer trans person.
The 2011 Youth Risk Behavior Survey found that about 11% of students attending LAUSD identified as LGBTQ, and 3,500 of those students said they were transgender.
Welcome, everyone. We're going to get started in just another couple of minutes.
Transgender students from the LA School District were among the hundreds of students who spent the day at an event called Models of Pride on the campus of USC this past fall. The conference was created more than 20 years ago by the district's Gay and Lesbian Education Commission as a way of providing a supportive and safe place for LGBTQ students to get together and learn outside of the classroom.
Spaces like don't emphasize trans people of color.
Oh yeah.
So like
not at all.
Yeah.
It's very white centered, you know, they're not really talking about like, you know, black and brown transgender and gender nonconforming bodies as they should.
Between workshops, a group of students, including 18-year-old Matthias, who identifies as queer and trans, had an opportunity to grade the district's efforts when it comes to the educational experiences of trans students. While earlier this year, the Human Rights Commission, the nation's largest LGBTQ civil rights organization, singled out LAUSD as one of the leading school districts in the country when it comes to upholding the rights of transgender students, Matthias, who identifies as trans and queer, has found his experiences to be a mixed bag.
I definitely have the, you know, verbal support of teachers, but when it comes to actually doing things to ease stuff on campus, unless you can do it yourself, nothing really happens.
As Matthias speaks, Sarah consistently nods in agreement. The 16-year-old has found some support on campus, but she also recalls the day a teacher asked students to split up by gender during class.
Student said, what if you're non-binary? And he was so convinced that there were no non-binary students in his class. I'm non-binary and was sitting in the front row. And he said, okay, well, if you're non-binary, stand up and raise your hand. You shouldn't be so afraid. And yeah, that was said to me.
But do you feel if you had gone to complain to the principal that they would have had your back?
I did. I talked to the head of student services, and she said that he probably didn't mean anything by it, and if I wanted to talk about it, I should take that up with him myself, and I didn't feel comfortable doing that.
Matthias has found himself in similar circumstances at his high school.
And while the staff was very supportive of my identity and me as a person, they weren't so good at actually enforcing anything. Like, I was physically harassed in a bathroom at my most recent high school, and you know, I reported it, and they were very sympathetic, and they definitely wanted to do something, but nothing was done because like, other trans students at my school have faced similar issues. There was no, you know, PSAs or anything put out.
I think that these schools are willing to listen, but it relies on a lot of self-advocacy in order to get anything done. And even then, a lot of the time I feel like people think it's just like your problem, like you have to deal with this on your own. Because you're almost as if like you're the one creating an issue.
They never say that you're the problem, but they kind of imply it with the fact that you have to fix it yourself.
Yes. I mean, no trans people should have to face this.
Eli Ehrlich is the director of Trans Student Educational Resources, an organization she founded 5 years ago to ensure that school districts around the country institute supportive policies for transgender students. She's clearly aware of the burdens transgender students face after attending school in a district in Northern California, where at the age of 8, she very vocally began identifying as a girl. But she felt zero support when she shared her gender identity with her elementary school teacher.
The teacher was, I mean, one of many who didn't see my identity as something that was healthy or normal or good for the educational environment. And so she and all of my elementary school teachers just disrespected and ignored it.
As part of the inspiration behind her bringing together students from around the country this summer for the Trans Youth Leadership Summit, she sees what's missing within school districts, including LAUSD, where she believes leadership has the best intentions.
LAUSD has a very comprehensive and helpful policy for trans students. It's been around for about a decade or so without any issues whatsoever. And I think it does provide a very good model for the rest of the country for protecting trans students.
But she says that's not enough.
Being so involved with policy, I do have to be somewhat critical of how the policy itself manifests, in that it won't actually protect the trans students. It just sets out guidelines. But very often we see teachers, faculty, and staff of different institutions from K-12 or college just ignoring these policies or bylaws and refusing to let trans students access programs and facilities with their own gender.
The LA School District's Judy Chasen acknowledges that while the district has been ahead of the curve, slow adapters to its policies can slow progress. But she says the district is committed to putting out the welcome mat for all students.
I'm not going to be naive and say that there was that everybody 100% of every staff and every community member was enthusiastic about these policies. But I think that when you have the top leadership of the school district making an affirmative message, that you are setting the tone. And I believe at the bottom line is that we need to be evaluated by who we bring in, not who we keep out.
That story was produced by Lena Nozizwe in Los Angeles. That wraps up this edition of Making Contact on the regulation of gender and its impact on transgender communities. To find out more about the people and organizations featured in today's program, check out our website at radioproject.org. That's also where you can download a copy of the show or get our podcast. Special thanks to this week's correspondents, Lena Nozizwe and Larry Buell. Lisa Redman is our executive director. Producers are Anita Johnson, Marie Che, and RJ Lozada. Juan Booth is Digital Content and Community Engagement Manager. Sabine Blazan is our Audience Engagement Director. And our Development Associate is Vera Teichholzler. I'm Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
You're listening to KBOO Portland here on the Queer Boo Hour, and coming up next is This Way Out, where they focus on chasing the troubling Trump trail back to Orlando's Pulse.
These three authors may have all come from fundamentalist backgrounds, but their stories are all different.
We will almost certainly see attempts from this administration to push us back into our closets. But I know we will fight tooth and nail to keep everything that we have won through decades of relentless activism.
Well, if gay liberation means freedom for all, a label is no liberation at all.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. There's no high court road to marriage equality in Northern Ireland. Three queer authors re-examined their religion and tracing the troubling Trump trail back to Orlando's Pulse. All that and more this week because you tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 19th, 2017. Northern Ireland's top court has ruled out a judicial road to marriage equality. Justice John O'Hara rejected two cases on August 17th at the High Court in Belfast that had challenged Northern Ireland's heterosexuals-only marriage laws, deciding that only lawmakers in the National Assembly can change them. In one case, a Northern Ireland gay couple that had legally married in London sought recognition of their marriage at home. And in the second, a lesbian couple and a gay male couple, who were each among the first to enter into less-than-equal civil partnerships when Northern Ireland created them in 2005, were asking the High Court to recognize their unions as marriages. Northern Ireland is the only major part of the United Kingdom to deny marriage equality to same-gender couples. London's Independent newspaper counted five different attempts in Northern Ireland's National Assembly to open civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples. The entrenched ruling Democratic Unionist Party has blocked all of them, and there's no sign that the government intends to change its resolute opposition.
Criticism continues in Australia over plans by the administration of Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull to hold a voluntary, non-binding postal plebiscite on marriage equality. The Liberal Party National Party coalition government has delayed a bill to define the processes for the postal survey until Australia's High Court issues a ruling on a case they'll hear on September 5th challenging the validity of the $122 million survey. If the postal plebiscite goes forward, according to Media Access Australia, blind or vision-impaired people won't be able to vote without outside help because a braille version of the ballot or an online voting option won't be available. An estimated 275,000 blind or vision-impaired Australians of voting age could be disenfranchised.
Meanwhile, one rebel senator is circulating amendments to government legislation that include changes in the Marriage Act to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. Senator Sky Kokoshi-Moore is also pushing for a free vote on the issue. I urge all parties to use this opportunity for parliamentarians to do the job we were elected to do, she said.
The Australian Bureau of Statistics, rather than the Electoral Commission, has been tasked with conducting the postal plebiscite. They're supposed to announce the results on November 15th, a week after mail-in balloting closes. But the Sydney Morning Herald reported this week that rank-and-file members of the Public Servants Union at the Statistics Bureau have grave doubts about the vote being done properly in the time frame ordered by the Turnbull government. Some call it a rush job that will not deliver an accurate picture of Australian opinion on the issue. The Community and Public Sector Union surveyed its members and found almost 3 in 4 respondents didn't think the Bureau was the proper agency to oversee the postal plebiscite. While the Bureau's boss conceded to his staff that getting the job done by November 15th will be challenging, one of his deputies dismissed the union members' concerns as representing only about 5% of the Bureau's workforce.
Elsewhere, landmark legislation to protect transgender people was introduced in the lower house of Pakistan's legislature this week. The Transgender Persons Protection of Rights Bill and the Transgender Persons Protection of Rights Criminal Law Amendment Bill would provide non-discrimination protections for the trans community and criminalize acts of violence and discrimination. Pakistan's constitution outlaws discrimination based on sex. Proponents of the legislation say that one of their goals is to expand that definition to include gender identity and expression. Physical violence against transgender people has been on the rise in Pakistan. One report documented at least 49 murders and 390 cases of physical violence against transgender people in the past 18 months. The recent widely reported brutal murder of a 17-year-old trans teenager who took the name of Mendy when she completed her transition at the age of 14
seems to have moved many to support the legislation. Sabahat Rizvi, an advocate for trans rights who's worked closely on developing the legislation, told the Washington Blade that the teen's murder has shaken all of the policymakers and mobilized the media. Pakistan's Supreme Court ruled in 2009 that transgender individuals have the right to designate themselves as third gender on official ID cards, but the government has since failed to advance that progressive decision.
Meanwhile, Joe Strauss, the Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives, foiled Governor Greg Abbott's renewed effort to pass a discriminatory bathroom bill that would have forced trans people to use sex-segregated public facilities that match their biological sex. Abbott's Republican-dominated Senate passed the bill during its regular session, but House Speaker Strauss, a more moderate Republican, expressed his strong opposition and wouldn't allow a vote in his chamber. The governor then called a special session at taxpayer expense to push through parts of his legislative agenda that didn't get approved during the regular session, and he identified the bathroom bill as his top priority. But history repeated itself this week when Strauss again blocked a vote in the House. The special session adjourned soon after the bathroom bill circled the drain. Tens of thousands of Texans spoke out against the bill during the regular and special legislative sessions, including CEOs of 27 Fortune 500 companies, nearly 500 faith leaders, and more than 50,000 people who signed petitions or testified against the measure. Abbott could push for the bill's passage again in the next legislative session.
In other news, at least three people were hospitalized in St. Petersburg with chemical burns this week after a group of nationalist skinheads used pepper spray against a group of about 100 LGBTQ people and their allies celebrating Pride in the Russian city's Field of Mars Park, which is designated as a free speech area. A dozen other Pride participants, including at least one journalist, were hurt in the melee. One of the organizers of the gathering said they were worried about such violence, but police denied their requests for protection. According to one Russian-language media report, the assaults came as the event was coming to a close, with participants lying on the grass, launching rainbow snakes into the sky, and singing songs. St. Petersburg authorities announced a few days later that they were opening a criminal investigation into the Pride assaults, but it's not known if anything will really come of that. Several of the attackers can be identified with video footage that's already been widely circulated. Organizers hailed the bravery of the Pride participants and said the city's eighth celebration of all things queer was the largest since 2010. At least one Pride participant was arrested. Lesbian activist Anna Grabatskaya was handcuffed by police for holding up a sign that read, "I love my wife." They considered that to be a violation of the country's ban on gay propaganda, for which Grabatskaya faces up to 10 days in jail.
A celebration of LGBTQ pride in Uganda has been shut down again. Organizers reluctantly canceled this week's events in and around Kampala in a statement via the Kuchu Times on August 16th, saying that going forward could have put innocent people's lives at risk. Uganda's Ethics and Integrity Minister, Simon Lokoto, directly threatened to use the police to attack and arrest anyone who dared to wave a rainbow flag. As he demonstrated last year, that was no idle threat. Police raided a kickoff Pride parade and blocked the planned 2016 march from happening. This morning, we woke up to a tirade of police surrounding the venue of the opening gala, the organizer's statement read. And later in the day, even as talks with police and other relevant authorities were ongoing, more deployment was made to the venues of the events that were to follow. Organizers vowed to continue the fight for equality. One day soon, their statement promised, "We will reap the fruits of our dedication and persistence."
And finally, advocates in Reykjavik may be pushing for the addition of one more letter to the all-inclusive alphabet soup that defines sexual and gender minority communities. They are asexuals who experience little or no sexual attraction to people of either gender. A group called Asexual Iceland marched for the first time in the city's queer pride parade on August 11th. One of the organizers said they hope to dispel many misconceptions about asexuality, an idea that's still relatively foreign to most people. Asexual Iceland might also like to see an A added to LGBTQI.
Now try it with the other eye, Francis.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 19, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org. You can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
In addition to the horrifying Pulse shooting, there have been a lot of upsetting changes in the past year. For me, the largest and most worrying change that occurred in the past year was our change in administration.
We'll take the pulse of queer youth under Trump later in the program. Reviewing three books on religion, This Way Out queer life and literature commentator Janet Mason sits down to drink from the silver cup, put on a straight face, and introduce us to a faithful son.
Just when I was starting to think that, well, maybe religion gets a bad rap, I was jolted back into reality by reading three recent books on the theme of religion written by queer writers. An article in the Baptist News Global cites Pew Research Center's findings that 62% of people now say homosexuality should be accepted by society. This is 12 points higher than when the same question was asked in 2007, when acceptance of homosexuality stood at 50%. That religion is changing, and so rapidly, is a good thing. We're all spiritual people, and religion does have something to offer. It can use its power to heal rather than to hurt. The first book I read was To Drink from the Silver Cup, From Faith Through Exile and Beyond, Terra Nova Books by Anna Redsand. As an adult, Redsand explored many of the same alternative spiritual traditions that have fueled me, such as yoga and the Gnostic Gospels. But since she was raised fundamentalist and encountered discrimination early on, she eventually found a Christian congregation that embraced her whole self. Redsand, who was raised by missionary parents in the Navajo Nation, is particularly insightful in her analysis of oppression. Redsand writes movingly about the alternative reality that many, especially those from religious backgrounds, experience. 21, when Stonewall happened in 1969, I was then grieving the end of a guilt-ridden clandestine affair with one of the nurses at the mission's hospital. In Straight Face, Greenbridge Press, author Brandon Wallace writes eloquently about the reality of living a dual existence as a gay person who had entered the ministry of a fundamentalist religion that denounced gays. He shows us how this is extremely unhealthy, but he also explores how he felt called to come out of the closet, become his authentic self, and help others, after he read about a gay teen who had died by suicide. While I was reading, all of my past came screaming back at me. I thought about my own suicide attempts, and all the nights I lay in bed and thought about doing the same thing. A Faithful Son is a novel by Michael Scott Garvin that explores the life of a young man growing up gay and fundamentalist in a small town in the South. Boys like me grow up crooked, he writes, and tells us the story of how and why the narrator had to leave the small town and move to Los Angeles. The narrator is devoted to his mother and writes movingly about her final days. Ultimately, he writes not about finding faith in the end, but about the narrator finding himself, and maybe in some ways that is the same thing. These three books are a testament to difference. These three authors may have all come from fundamentalist backgrounds, but their stories are all different. What they have in common was that all three authors were raised in a strong faith that gave them something, but to preserve themselves, they had to leave. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Everyone thinks that I'm a freak, the way I dress, the way I speak. I'm too thin, I hate my voice. I'd switch lives if I had the choice. I'll be tall and rich someday. Everything will go my way. Someday, someday.
You don't have to be a freak or even young for the last year to seem fraught with challenges. A commentator from the LGBTQ Youth Outcasting radio show shares her thoughts about our post-Pulse world.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Max, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Brianna revisits the topic of the massacre at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida on June 12, 2016, and discusses events that have affected the LGBTQ community in the year that has passed.
A little over a year ago, the largest shooting on American soil took place in Orlando, Florida. On June 12, 2016, between the hours of 2 and 5 a.m., 49 people died and 58 were injured during an attack at Pulse, a gay nightclub. The LGBTQ community was in shock, and the media ran the story for days, focusing on possible connections between the shooter and terrorist organizations. I wrote a piece last year that shared my feelings surrounding what happened at Pulse and how the mainstream media portrayed it. It's been a turbulent 14 months, so I think it's beneficial to look at what's changed in our community, what might change in the future, and how those changes affect us. Not much has changed in how mainstream media treats the attack on Pulse, except that there isn't much of it anymore. The only memorials for Pulse victims I have seen have come from the LGBTQ community. There is nothing I have seen in mainstream media that has addressed the anniversary of that night. The media coverage on this attack was short and filled with talk of ISIS-fueled terrorism, with only a few placing emphasis on the LGBTQ aspect of the shooting. These circumstances remind me of the upstairs lounge fire, which, until the Pulse massacre, had been the most deadly anti-LGBTQ attack in American history. The fire at the upstairs lounge, located in New Orleans, Louisiana, killed 32 people in 1973 and received national news coverage for only 3 days. And once the media found out that it had been a gay bar, the coverage took on a horrendously derogatory tone. While coverage of the Pulse massacre hasn't been as directly homophobic as the coverage for the upstairs lounge, mainstream media has largely omitted that it was a gay nightclub and that homophobia was almost certainly the shooter's motivation. In addition to the horrifying Pulse shooting, there have been a lot of upsetting changes in the past year. For me, the largest and most worrying change that occurred in the past year was our change in administration. I refer, of course, to the 2016 presidential election. It was hands down the most divisive, confusing, and stressful election we've had, at least in my memory. From rumors of Russian interference to a now victorious candidate with a habit of contradicting not only everything he's ever said, but everything his aides and surrogates have said, the election alone was exhausting. For the longest time, it was impossible to tell exactly what President Trump's position on LGBTQ issues was, but his opinions were made clear in a series of tweets on July 26th. Claiming to have consulted with military leaders, President Trump announced that the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. Trump stated that the military cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgenders in the military would entail. On the campaign trail, Trump proudly declared that he would be protecting the rights of LGBTQ citizens, but this seems to be another campaign promise he's forgotten. The decision to ban transgender people from the military doesn't make sense if you use medical costs to justify it, as Trump did. According to the RAND Corporation's research, transition-related medical procedures raise defense health costs by roughly 0.04 to 0.13%. That amount is so small that it's laughable the president is so concerned about it, especially when you consider that the military spends about 10 times as much money on medication for erectile dysfunction, according to PolitiFact. And if Trump were really so concerned about taxpayers' money and how it is used, he wouldn't take any more trips down to Mar-a-Lago, which have already cost taxpayers millions of dollars, according to multiple sources. While he continues his attempts to undo everything put in place during Barack Obama's time as president, President Trump has cemented his stance against the transgender community. In doing so, he has made clear his opinion of the LGB part of the community as well. In addition to the announcement that transgender service members could soon be fired, the Trump administration has recently been taking an even more anti-LGBTQ tone. The Department of Justice, under the leadership of Attorney General Jeff Sessions, has argued that sexual orientation discrimination is not covered by the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Despite the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's published position, the Department of Justice does not believe that discrimination based on sexual orientation is sex discrimination. President Trump has also recently appointed Sam Brownback to be Ambassador of Religious Freedom, a position responsible for promoting religious freedom as an element of U.S. foreign policy. Sam Brownback has been historically anti-LGBTQ, opposing same-sex marriage and signing state legislation to exclude LGBTQ university students while he was governor of Kansas. He uses religion as a conduit to encourage traditional marriage between a man and woman, a view that seems out of place for someone who is meant to be promoting freedom of religion. Meanwhile, Vice President Mike Pence's views are clear. As governor of Indiana, he pushed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which allowed businesses the right to refuse services to LGBTQ people. In addition, Pence's crusade against Planned Parenthood, his opposition of needle exchange programs, and his documented desire to divert money intended for HIV prevention to organizations providing conversion therapy led to an outbreak of HIV in Scott County. He has also said that gay couples signal societal collapse, opposed a law that would prohibit workplace discrimination against LGBTQ people, rejected a directive that would allow transgender students to use the bathroom of the gender they identify with, opposed the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and more. In February of 2016, Justice Antonin Scalia died, leaving an empty seat on the Supreme Court. Following his death, Senate Republicans vowed to block President Obama's Supreme Court nomination until a new president took office. President Trump's Supreme Court pick, Neil Gorsuch, has already taken an extremely anti-LGBTQ stance. Gorsuch made clear in his 2004 philosophy dissertation for Oxford University that he did not believe the Constitution protected the right for same-sex couples to marry. It's unclear whether or not his opinions have changed over time. Rumors have been flying for months that Justice Kennedy, so often the court's most influential swing vote, will retire in the coming year. If Kennedy retires, President Trump will be able to nominate another judge for the Supreme Court, and could very well nominate a more conservative judge. This could mean decades of conservative domination in the nation's highest court, a nightmare for LGBTQ individuals whose rights could be severely threatened. Right now, things are not looking good for the future of the LGBTQ community under the Trump administration. Looking at the views of these leaders, we can expect attacks on our rights to become more common. We will almost certainly see attempts from this administration to push us back into silence, back into our closets. But I know the LGBTQ community. I know we will not tolerate these attacks. We will fight tooth and nail to keep everything that we have won through decades of relentless activism. The last year has been full of surprises and shocking political developments. It has been full of scandal and controversy. The year ahead of us will likely be the same. We cannot get tired. We cannot stop fighting for each other. If the world seems to forget us the way they have forgotten the victims of Pulse, then we must do what we have always done and continue to defend this community. And we must continue to demand equality for every member of the community.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 50 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to the show. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy this way.
The BBC's live July 30th I Feel Love concert marked a UK legal milestone, the 50th anniversary of the Sexual Offences Act, which partially decriminalized private consensual adult same-gender sex. Trailblazing singer-songwriter Tom Robinson was among the featured entertainers, and he sang an updated version of his classic anthem, Glad to Be Gay, a song the same BBC had banned when it came out in 1978. A couple of days before the big show, Robinson paid a visit to Gay Star News and treated them to an exclusive acoustic preview, adding some new lyrics at the end.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Just sing if you're happy that way. For 42 years now I've fought for the right for people to love just whoever they like. Today we can laugh as we march to the park, and Clause 28's been consigned to the past. Well, if gay liberation means freedom for all, a label is no liberation at all. Bisexual, lesbian, flexible, straight, we're in, we're human, and all happy to say. Glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy this way.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Francis O'Brien and Wenzel Jones, produced by Steve Pride, Janet Mason, and Outcasters Max and Brianna, produced by Mark Sophos. Bronski Beat, David Brown, and Tom Robinson performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KLAI, Laytonville, California, WLRI, Christiana, Pennsylvania, 2NSB, Chatswood, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 34th annual Hawthorne Street Fair, Sunday, August 27th on Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. The Hawthorne Street Fair, now in its 34th year, features music, activities for kids and adults alike, entertainment, local businesses, and community vendors. Again, that's the 34th annual Hawthorne Street Fair, Sunday, August 27th from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. on Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Did you know that KBOO podcasts all our news and talk shows?
You can find the podcast on KBOO's website, kboo.fm, on Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Just search for your favorite show and hit subscribe to get all the latest episodes downloaded to your favorite device.
Or search for KBOO on iTunes, Google Play to get all the KBOO podcasts.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is now 6:58. Next up is Hard Knock Radio,
news and views from a hip-hop perspective.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one. News, views, and hip-hop.
This is Sister Soulja on Hard Knock Radio. Listen closely.
¿Qué pasa, raza? This is Deuce Eclipse, the Oi Joaquin, your parte chino. Check it out. Listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Hey, this is Patrice Rushen. And whenever I'm in the Bay Area and I need good information and great radio, it's all about Hard Knock Radio.
Hanging out with you this afternoon. In the building with us is somebody who's no stranger to our airwaves. Sometimes you hear his name on our drops. Well-known activist, somebody who was in the middle of a storm around immigration. His name is Eddie Zhang. And we wanted to talk to Eddie because as the eyes of the country and the world have been focused on the current administration, many of us are seeing some of the policies and some of the challenges facing people almost as if it's brand new. I mean, we recently had a family that had been here in this country for 30 years, had bought a house, raised their kids here. They were caught in the crosshairs of the immigration battle after having a 20-year fight to try and stay, and they were deported. That was the family of Maria Mendoza Sanchez. That was her family. Eddie Zhang was somebody who was battling to stay in this country and